Welcome to Voter Information, the show that looks at elections in the city, the state, and the nation. I'm your election guru, Mark Braun here. Glad you could join us today. And I remind you, you're listening to a recording provided for the use of those who are blind or print impaired. Materials or items read on Airs LA are the copyright property of the original authors and publishers. No unauthorized use or duplication is permitted. Okay? Okay. So it is national stuff, and we will get to those in just a few minutes. There is one thing... Two things, actually, that we'd like to cover beforehand. We have this one from the Los Angeles Times, Thursday, April 23rd, 2026. Representative Scott, a Georgia Democrat, dies at 80, by Bill Varro, Matt Brown, and Jeff Amy. Atlanta. U.S. Representative David Scott, a Georgia Democrat and the first black chairman of the House Agriculture Committee, has died. He was 80. Scott, who was seeking his 13th term in Congress despite challenges from within his party, was once a leading voice for Democrats on issues related to farm aid policy and food aid for consumers and a prominent black member of the party's moderate Blue Dog Caucus. But he faced criticism in recent years because of declining health and during a primary challenge in 2024 and facing another one at the time of his death. Democrats on Capitol Hill praised the longtime lawmaker. The news of Congressman Scott's passing is deeply sad, House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries told reporters on Wednesday. David Scott was a trailblazer who served the district that he represented admirably, rose up from humble beginnings to become the first African-American ever to chair the House Ag Committee, Jeffries wrote. He cared about the people that he represented. He was fiercely committed to getting things done for the people of the great state of Georgia, and he'll be deeply missed. News of Scott's death came during the Congressional Black Caucus's weekly luncheon on Capitol Hill. The Black Caucus chair, Representative Yvette Clark, told lawmakers at the outset of the meeting. Scott's death slightly widens Republicans' narrow House majority going into the thick of this midterm election year. The GOP began the current Congress with a 220 to 215 advantage. But the margin has fluctuated. Scott is the fourth House Democrat to die in office during this Congress. Scott has been mostly absent from the campaign trail in 2024 and 2026 and had become a noted example of Democrats' aging leadership targeted by younger generations of the left. He dodged questions from reporters when he qualified for another term in March, but he earlier dismissed pressure to retire. Thank God I'm in good health, moving and doing the people's work, the congressman said in 2024. His wife and campaign advisor, Alfredia Scott, was even more direct. When the congressman decides to leave, he won't be pushed out, she said in 2024. He will bow out. State officials will have to schedule a special election to fill out the rest of Scott's term, which could overlap with elections to choose a representative for the next two-year term. Early in-person voting starts Monday for May 19 party primaries for the next full term. David Albert Scott was born in rural Anor, South Carolina on June 27, 1945 in the era of Jim Crow segregation. He spent part of his childhood in Scranton, Pennsylvania, along with stints in New York and Florida. Scott graduated from Florida A&M University, one of the nation's largest historically black college campuses. And in office, he was an outspoken advocate for federal support of HBCUs. Scott also earned an MBA from the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School in 1969. He settled in Atlanta, opening an advertising business as got his start in politics as a staffer on Andrew Young's 1972 congressional campaign. Young went on to be Atlanta mayor and United Nations ambassador under President Carter, another Georgian. The support of Young and basketball legend Henry Aaron, who was the older brother of Scott's wife, helped launch Scott into Congress in 2002, said Democratic State Senator Emanuel Jones. He was opposing Scott in the May 19 primary, although he called Scott a good friend. Scott was one of a pioneering generation of black state lawmakers in Georgia, winning election to the State House in 1974 and the State Senate in 1982 before being elected to Congress. Once identifying as a moderate blue dog, Scott sponsored a law mandating a moment of silent school prayer in Georgia. He evolved into a more mainstream liberal. State Senator Ed Harbison, a Columbus Democrat elected to the body in 1992, said he arrived to find Scott well-established in a then-majority Democratic legislature. He said Scott had a sense of righteousness and would embrace issues even if they wouldn't help him raise campaign money or win attention, saying Scott judged himself on how effective he was in helping the people he set out to help. Scott served decades in Congress while living outside his district after maps were redrawn. He maintained support, focusing intently on constituent service, including hosting job and health fairs. Among his notable achievements on Capitol Hill, Scott secured $80 million for historically black land grant schools as part of the 2018 Farm Bill. The money was steered to agriculture-related scholarships at 19 campuses. He helped write various housing and mortgage aid measures, and he pushed for better health care and other benefits for veterans and their families. On foreign policy, Scott was an outspoken advocate for NATO. Scott's fellow Democrats ousted him from this post as ranking minority member on the Agriculture Committee in 2024 amid concerns about his age and health. Scott is survived by Alfredia Scott, the couple's two daughters and grandchildren. That was Representative Scott, a Georgia Democrat, dies at 80, by Bill Barrow, Matt Brown, and Jeff Amy, from the Los Angeles Times, Thursday, April 23, 2026. Barrow, Brown, and Amy write for the Associated Press. Brown reported from Washington. All right, now we're going to go stateside for this upcoming article regarding our first gubernatorial debate. From the California section of the Los Angeles Times, Friday, April 24, 2026. No big breakout moments, but some telling differences did emerge. The issues of social media and homelessness drew a few sparks by Anita Chabria, columnist. Two of our esteemed gubernatorial candidates, the cowboy and the dilettante, apparently could not find ties for the first debate Wednesday night, showing up with dress shirts casually unbuttoned. Mr. Middle Ground sported a scruffy sort of beard, apparently unable to pay for a razor in the midst of California's affordability crisis. It's a trademark look that always makes me think if this doesn't work out, he'll opt to live on a boat in some not-too-expensive slip by the bay. The billionaire wore Nikes instead of dress shoes, a sartorial nod perhaps to his bid to be the outsider fighter, or maybe just his feet hurt. The last two contenders were remarkably unremarkable. Why start with fashion? Honestly, it might be the most interesting and telling bit of insight that came from this first of three chances for our next governor to let us know who they are and what they're made of. If the debate showed us anything, it's that none of these candidates are hiding follow-me charisma or an excitement-inducing political vision for our collective future. Yet there were a few decent jabs here and there about Tom Steyer's money, Katie Porter's temper, Matt Mahan's tech ties, and Chad Bianco's far-right worldview. But even those were predictable. Still, in between the yawns, there were a couple of answers worth noting, ones that might actually give us insight into how the Democratic candidates differ. Despite all the hype, it seems increasingly unlikely that the two Republicans will come out of the primary, and even more unlikely that a Democratic versus Republican race, the Democrat would lose in blue California. I'll start with the surprising place where I agreed with Steve Hilton, the Republican endorsed by President Trump. The candidates were asked if they would support a ban on social media for kids under age 16. This is a quickly accelerating idea not beloved by tech companies. Australia and Indonesia already have bans in place. Other countries, including France and Portugal, have them in the works. Florida banned children under 14 from opening social media accounts on their own last year. And a Los Angeles jury last month dealt a blow to Meta and YouTube when it found that platforms had damaged the mental health of a young woman with their addictive features. Hilton took the ban question a step further, saying it misses the point. He has long argued that it isn't just social media that is the problem, but having kids starting at a digital device for hours a day instead of interacting in the real world. It was one of the most genuine answers of the night. We've got to get to the heart of this problem, and that's the devices and the screens, he said. I think that every parent in their heart knows that it's wrong. While Steyer and Javier Becerra, the former California Attorney General, both said they would support such a ban, the remaining three candidates hedged or said they would not. Porter said no to a ban under age 16, but said she might consider a different ban without being specific. Mahan, who was backed by significant tech money, and Bianco said they believed requiring parental consent was the way to go, though Mahan said he would ban devices in schools. As Becerra pointed out, kids have died as a result of their use of social media, so it's a place where policy matters. And if a candidate doesn't see government's role in controlling the dangers of social media, what will happen with artificial intelligence? The candidates also have differences in how they would handle homelessness and the related crisis of housing affordability, though the devil was often buried in the details. For at least for Democrats, Bianco, the difference was stark. "We are not dealing with homeless, so stop calling it homeless," he snapped at the moderators. "It has nothing to do with homes. This is drug and alcohol-induced psychosis, mental illness." Of course this is wrong. Last year, the UC San Francisco Benioff Homelessness and Housing Initiative released the results of the state's most comprehensive survey of homeless people. It found that for most people living on our streets, the cost of housing had simply become unsustainable. It also found an increasing percentage of those folks were older, almost half were over 50, and had become homeless after a hardship such as an illness or a job loss. It's also families who are fleeing intimate partner and domestic violence, Porter said. It's people who are double and tripled up. It's people who are living in their cars on our college campuses. Homelessness comes in a lot of different forms. Most of the Democratic candidates seem to understand this and embraced the increasingly popular idea of putting more money into helping people stay housed after a hardship instead of trying to get them housed after they lose their place. "How can I help you keep your home?" Becerra said. "Because it costs me so much more money to pick you off the streets, provide you with the assistance in shelter, than it does to keep you in the home." But the issue of homelessness is also where daylight emerged between the candidates. Steyer said he and his wife had helped finance low-barrier homes, not just shelter spaces, where people do not need to be addiction-free and where they can bring pets, two issues that are common hindrances for moving folks off sidewalks voluntarily. Mahan, the mayor of San Jose, who often touts his city's success at moving people indoors, agreed that emergency and interim housing was critical, but also voiced support for forcing folks to accept help. Last year, San Jose passed an ordinance he backed that some say criminalizes homelessness. A person can be cited twice for refusing shelter, and a third refusal within 18 months can lead to an arrest. "When shelter was available, we required that people come indoors," Mahan said, adding, "we have to be able to mandate treatment." It's a controversial position, but also one that is increasingly popular. Governor Gavin Newsom has backed mandated treatment in a lighter form with his care court, which is technically voluntarily. And the movement to require people to accept a shelter space or face arrest is growing on the right and even the Democratic middle. But there is a fine and dangerous line with mandated treatment and shelter requirements that is often pushed further and further to the side in favor of the clean, safe streets argument. "Whenever we start locking folks up, whether it's in mental wards or immigration detention centers or jails, we should be careful that expediency isn't trumping ethics." Of course, the debate would not be complete without the Democratic candidate's position on our president, speaking of ethics. Steyer was gleeful that Trump had come after him on social media, a point of pride that he is a relevant figure in the fight against MAGA. He also said he would abolish immigration and customs enforcement if he could, which he can't. Becerra highlighted as many lawsuits as California Attorney General during Trump's first term and pledged to keep fighting. Porter leaned into her time in Congress and her efforts to help Democrats in other races win. Mahan took a different route, pledging to fight when necessary, but adding, "We need a partnership and we need to find common ground with this administration on certain issues." Newsom learned the hard way that common ground is what Trump says it is and shifts without warning or reason. So what's the takeaway from all this? Boring dad, feisty mom, rich do-gooder, striving newcomer, MAGA 1, MAGA 2. None of them hit it out of the park, but no one struck out. Maybe next time. There was no big breakout moments, but some telling differences did emerge, by Anita Chabria, columnist, from the California section of the Los Angeles Times, Friday, April 24th, 2026. Now on to some national news. This one is from the Los Angeles Times, Saturday, February 21st, 2026. Many Democrats are still down on the party, a new poll reveals, by Lindley Sanders. Washington. Democratic candidates have notched a series of wins in recent special elections, but a new APNORC poll finds views of the Democratic Party among rank-and-file Democrats have not bounced back since President Trump's win in 2024. Only about 7 in 10 Democrats have a positive view of the Democratic Party, according to a new poll from the Associated Press NORC Center for Public Affairs Research. Though the overwhelming majority of Democrats still feel good about their party, they're much less positive than they've been in the past. The midterm elections are still many months away, and lackluster favorability doesn't spell electoral doom. Other factors could benefit Democrats this year, including broadly negative views of Trump and other Republicans. Additionally, recent polling has found that independents tend to identify more with a party that's out of power, which could boost Democrats this year, too. Historically, the party not in the White House has picked up seats in Congress in midterm elections. But the lack of enthusiasm could be a longer-term problem for the party. Democrats' favorability of their party plummeted after the 2024 election from 85% in September 2024 to 67% in October 2025. And despite overwhelming victories in November's off-season elections and a string of wins since then, those views haven't recovered. Other polling indicates that Democrats are deeply frustrated with their party. At the same time, there's some potential good news for Democrats in the new poll. Although Republicans are slightly more enthusiastic about their own party, Americans in general don't think highly of either party. Healthcare is on many Americans' minds this year, and it's an issue where Democrats have a large advantage, according to the survey. Meanwhile, Republicans have lost some ground on two of Trump's signature issues, the economy and immigration, although Americans don't necessarily trust Democrats more on those issues as a result. Other polling suggests that Democrats' post-2024 slump is unusually severe. In Gallup's measure of favorability, Democrats' positive views of their own party declined about 12 percentage points in the last year. That marked the lowest measure in that question's history, which dates to 2001. Notably, Democrats did not see a similar decline after their first loss to Trump in 2016. That diminished view of the Democratic Party in the APNORC polling is consistent regardless of Democrats' age, race, ideology, or educational background, suggesting that appealing to a specific group or two won't fix the problem. A separate survey from the Pew Research Center last fall found roughly two-thirds of Democrats in September said their own party made them frustrated, compared with just 4 in 10 Republicans. Among those frustrated Democrats, about 4 in 10 felt their party was not fighting hard enough against Trump, while about 1 in 10 said there was a lack of good leadership or a cohesive agenda. It's not just Democrats. Americans aren't thrilled with either party right now. Roughly one quarter of Americans have a negative view of both the Democratic Party and the Republican Party, according to the APNORC data. That double negativity is especially sharp among independents and Americans under 45. About half of U.S. adults view only one party positively, and only about 1 in 10 feel good about both parties. But Democrats' loss of goodwill is more recent. Polling over the last 25 years from Gallup shows that Americans used to feel much more positively toward the Democrats. Around 2010, public sentiment turned against the Democrats. Since then, at least half of Americans have held unfavorable views of the party, according to Gallup. Negative views of the Democrats now rival the most negative points in time for the Republicans. With healthcare at the top of Americans' priority list as costs and premiums rise, Democrats have a possible advantage going into the midterm year. About one-third of U.S. adults, 35%, trust the Democrats to do a better job handling healthcare, compared with 23% for the Republicans. That is broadly in line with the last time the question was asked in October 2025. At the same time, Republicans have lost some ground on the issues that were key to Trump's re-election, the economy and immigration, but Democrats haven't managed to capitalize on it. Only about 3 in 10 U.S. adults, 31%, say Republicans are the party they trust to handle the economy, down slightly from 36% last year. But Democrats haven't made any gains on the issue. Rather, slightly more Americans now say they trust neither party to handle the economy. Neither party has an edge on who is better equipped to manage the cost of living, which was first asked in the most recent poll. Republicans are also down slightly on handling immigration. Only about one-third of U.S. adults trust them to better handle immigration, an apparent decrease from 39% in October. Democrats didn't appear to benefit from that shift either. That was many Democrats are still down on the party, a new poll reveals, by Lindley Sanders from the Los Angeles Times, Saturday, February 21, 2026. Sanders writes for the Associated Press. The AP NORC poll of 1,156 adults was conducted February 5th through the 8th using a sample drawn from NORC's probability-based AmeriSpeak panel, which is designed to be representative of the U.S. population. The margin of sampling error for adults overall is plus or minus 3.9 percentage points. The margin of sampling error for Democrats overall is plus or minus 6 percentage points. And now on to other races throughout the country, including the race for governor in Vermont. It has a most unusual candidate here. From the Nation section of the Los Angeles Times, Monday, March 30, 2026, a 14-year-old is running for governor in Vermont. By Amanda Swinhart. Stowe, Vermont. Looking back, gubernatorial candidate Dean Roy says his political ambition started in the eighth grade, and by that he means last year. After working as a legislative page at the Vermont State House, the 14-year-old freshman at Stowe High School has his sights set on the corner office. In November, he'll be the first candidate for governor under age 18 to appear on the state's general election ballot. I don't expect necessarily to win, he said. What I do expect is to start the movement and get more young people to come in behind me and say, yeah, we also want to make change. Another eighth grader, Ethan Sonnenborn, sought the Democratic nomination for governor in 2018, but finished last at a four-way primary. Roy secured a spot in the general election by creating his own third party, the Freedom and Unity Party. Both were able to run because the state constitution sets no minimum age for gubernatorial candidates, requiring only that candidates have resided in the state for 4 years. I know it sounds crazy, a 14-year-old running for governor, but honestly, look at the people in charge right now, Dean said in a post on his campaign's Instagram page. They've been doing this forever, and things aren't working. Nearly all the other states set age requirements for governor, often 30 years old. In Kansas, lawmakers added a requirement that gubernatorial candidates be at least 25 years old in 2018 after six teenagers ran for office. Peter Teachout, a professor at Vermont Law and Graduate School, has a different take than Dean on Vermont's constitution. He points to a section in the document referring to what qualifies someone to be entitled to the privileges of the vote of a voter, and that is that they must be 18 years of age. Even under Dean's interpretation, Teachout doesn't predict a win for the teenager. In theory, a four-year-old could run for governor. Should we be worried about it? No, he said. Vermonters can be a little cantankerous and provocative just for the fun of it, but it is not something that they are likely to support in this context. But Dean's former history teacher, James Carpenter, said he thinks it's great that Dean is giving it his all. Though most 14-year-olds aren't concerned with property taxes or health care, Carpenter describes Roy as an old soul with endless curiosity. It just really shows what type of kid Dean is. He's very earnest in what he's doing. There's no gimmick behind this, he said. I think he blends that youthful optimism with some pragmaticism that few kids have. Dean, who said he doesn't identify with either major party, said housing is the most important issue facing the state. He's also thought about how he'd juggle school with a full-time job as governor, saying he'd consider online classes and would do his homework at night after work. The current governor, Republican Phil Scott, applauds Dean's interest in politics and public service, but questions whether someone so young is ready for the responsibilities that come with running a state. He believes it's important for our youth to get involved, said Press Secretary Amanda Wheeler. But the governor also believes that a teenager may not be best suited to serve in that role given the lack of experience and lived perspectives youth have at that point in their lives. Dean disagrees that age has anything to do with whether a candidate is fit to run for office. What I'm aiming for is that these career politicians look at me and they say, oh my God, he actually has a chance to disrupt things, he said. If I can get people to think that I'm a threat to them, then I know that's been a success. Because what I want is to show them that the youth have a voice. We're going to make change. The future is now. That was a 14-year-old is running for governor in Vermont by Amanda Swinhart from the Nation section of the Los Angeles Times, Monday, March 30, 2026. Swinhart writes for the Associated Press. AP reporter Holly Raymer in Concord, New Hampshire, contributed to this report. And moving on to the South, a familiar face is trying to make a comeback. From the Los Angeles Times, Tuesday, March 31st, 2026, South Carolina's Mark Sanford joins House race at last minute by Meg Kinnard and Jeffrey Collins, Columbia, South Carolina. Mark Sanford, the former South Carolina congressman and governor, whose political ascendancy was stalled in by a 2009 affair, wants to return to Congress again. Just hours ahead of the deadline to do so, Sanford filed paperwork with state officials to run in the June 9 GOP primary for South Carolina's 1st District seat, which he has held twice before. Sanford's first political office was in the 1st District. An outsider with almost no name recognition, he navigated a primary for the open seat, finishing second before winning the runoff. He served for 6 years in the House before his outside run at governor again pushed his way through a crowded primary, then knocking off the last Democrat to hold the office. But his 8 years were overshadowed by the Appalachian Trail, which became shorthand for Sanford's disappearance to go to Argentina to see his lover. Sanford's wife, family, and his staff didn't know where he was. Beating back both an ethics inquiry and calls to resign, Sanford held fast, leaving office on his own terms. In 2013, Sanford won back his old seat, beating 15 other candidates in a primary and runoff. He won two more full terms before falling to a GOP challenger in 2018 who had President Trump's backing. The seat would go on to flip to Democratic hands that fall for the first time in decades, won back by GOP Representative Nancy Mace in 2020. Mace is running for governor this year. Sanford 65 also briefly ran for president in 2020, challenging Trump for the nomination and what he characterized as a long-shot effort around warnings about the national debt. Some, including Sanford's former gubernatorial staffers, initially questioned whether the effort was a serious one, posting that it might be an effort to stay relevant after the 2018 defeat. Sanford dropped out of the contest just ahead of the New Hampshire primary. Sanford's home state would ultimately opt not to hold a 2020 GOP presidential primary, clearing the way for Trump's nomination in South Carolina. Sanford did not immediately return a message seeking comment Monday. True to the themes that have dominated his political thinking, an email released on Sanford's candidacy focused on the national debt, with the candidate saying he felt the 1st District voters wanted a representative who is an advocate for financial sanity that has been lost in Washington for all too long. Since leaving the House, Sanford has hung on to more than $1.3 million in a federal campaign account, funds that he can now use in a primary already crowded with multiple Republican and Democratic candidates. That was South Carolina's Mark Sanford joins House race at last minute, Meg Kinnard and Jeffrey Collins. From the Los Angeles Times, Tuesday, March 31st, 2026. Kinnard and Collins write for the Associated Press. Now, an article regarding Michigan's Senate race from the Nation section of the Los Angeles Times, Wednesday, April 8, 2026. How big of a tent do Democrats want? Michigan contest tests limits, by Joey Capaletti. Ann Arbor, Michigan. By the time Hassan Piker took the microphone at two campaign events with a Senate candidate in Michigan on Tuesday, the popular but controversial online streamer had already generated plenty of noise inside the Democratic Party. Some have pitched him as a gateway to young people, particularly young men who have drifted to the right in recent years. Others fear he is a sign of the party beholden to its extremes, pointing to inflammatory rhetoric like Hamas is a thousand times better than Israel, describing some Orthodox Jews as inbred, and that America deserved 9/11. Piker's scheduled appearances with Abdul El Sayed, a progressive candidate in the Democratic primary for the U.S. Senate in Michigan, have catalyzed questions about how big a tent the party wants to build as it works to regain power in the midterm elections and win back the White House. In an interview with the Associated Press, Piker cast the reaction as part of a broader fight for the party's future. There is definitely, I think, a battle right now for who gets to be more representative of the National Democratic Party, he said. Piker remains largely unapologetic for his past remarks, although he has said some were poorly worded. He called the renewed focus on them totally ridiculous, especially considering that there are far more consequential things happening in the world right now. The super wealthy are picking apart the scraps of the American carcass like a bunch of vultures, and some of the Democrats are talking about their affiliations with a Twitch streamer, Piker said. I think Americans understand that this is totally ridiculous. The 34-year-old Turkish-American streamer has 3.1 million followers on Twitch and 1.8 million on YouTube, making him an influential voice in a shifting media landscape where mainstream outlets are losing clout. Unlike traditional podcasts, his live streams are often unscripted and interactive. He has hosted prominent Democrats, including Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and New York City Mayor Zoran Mamdani. Piker said he is a megaphone for an angry electorate, and he believes the criticism that he faces is less about him personally and more about what he represents, a younger, more populist wing of the party. I think they find me to be a more appropriate target than to just actively disparage the voters, he said. El Sayed, who has been backed by progressive Senator Bernie Sanders, independent of Vermont, tried to channel that appeal in appearances at Michigan State University and the University of Michigan on Tuesday. A physician and former county health official, he is locked in a competitive primary with U.S. Representative Haley Stevens and State Senator Mallory McMorrow. It's a critical race for a seat being vacated by Democratic Senator Gary Peters, and the winner of the primary will probably face former Republican Representative Mike Rogers. The three candidates have differing views on U.S. foreign policy toward Israel. Both El Sayed and McMorrow have described the war in Gaza as a genocide. El Sayed wants to stop all military assistance, while McMorrow has pushed for a two-state solution. Stevens has described herself as a proud pro-Israel Democrat. McMorrow told Jewish Insider that Piker was someone who says extremely offensive things in order to generate clicks and views and followers, and she compared him to white supremacist Nick Fuentes. Trump's decision to dine with Fuentes between his presidencies ignited a firestorm of controversy over his association with extreme voices on the right. Stevens said El Sayed is choosing to campaign with someone who has a history of anti-Semitic rhetoric. El Sayed responded to the backlash over Piker by saying, "If we want to have a conversation where we're actually bringing people together about the things that we need and deserve, we're going to have to go to unlikely and uncommon places." Not everyone in the party wants to go to those places. Representative Brad Schneider of Illinois, who chairs the Moderate New Democratic Coalition and co-chairs the Congressional Jewish Caucus, called Piker an unapologetic anti-Semite. "We are deeply disappointed by the decision to host a speaker at the University of Michigan with a documented record of anti-Semitic rhetoric," said Rabbi David Rosen, the chief executive of Michigan Hillel. "Such invitations normalize hate and contribute to a hostile environment for Jewish students." Piker said he is not anti-Semitic and describes himself as anti-Zionist. Hostility towards Israel has risen across the political spectrum and became a fault line within the Democratic Party during the war in Gaza. Criticism has centered on Piker's past remarks. After the October 7, 2023 attack on Israel, Piker argued that whether reports of sexual violence are accurate doesn't change the dynamic of the conflict. He has repeatedly said the core issue of Israel's conduct is Israel's conduct in Gaza. Piker has drawn a backlash for a comment in which he said America deserved 9/11, made during a 2019 live stream while discussing U.S. foreign policy. Piker said the remark was poorly worded and added in the AP interview that he didn't mean that Americans deserved to die. That was How Big of a Tent Do Democrats Want? Michigan Contest Test Limits by Joey Capoletti from the Nation section of the Los Angeles Times, Wednesday, April 8, 2026. Capoletti writes for the Associated Press. So with the time that we have left, let's review candidates for the races that we have just read about today. So on the we're talking about the Vermont governor's race. The incumbent is Republican Phil Scott, and amongst the Republican candidates, the only potential is the incumbent governor Phil Scott himself. He's the only one that's listed. And on the Democratic side, those that are officially declared are Amanda Janu, an economist, and Allie Richards, a University of Vermont Medical Center board chair. And those that have publicly expressed interest are Vermont State Treasurer Mike Piachak, and a potential is Charity Clark, Vermont Attorney General. And as far as third-party candidates are concerned, we just read about them, the Freedom and Unity Party, Dean Roy, who is a high school student and former legislative page. Well, now let's check the candidates for the congressional race in South Carolina's 1st District that is represented by Nancy Mace. I'm looking, and it looks like that Mark Sanford and the Republican side has withdrawn from that race, leaving the declared candidates being car dealer Dan Brown, Dorchester County Councilor Jay Byers, Charleston County Councilor Jenny Costa Honeycutt, Logan Cunningham, a Beaufort County Councilor and candidate for the district in 2020, Tyler Dykes, convicted participant in the January 6th United States Capitol attack, Kendall Ludden, an attorney, Sam McCown, a physician, Alex Penbath, a commercial pilot, and Mark Smith, a state representative from the 99th Congressional District, oh, and one Cindy Waggers Riley. Among the Democrats in that district, Francina Dantzler, an educator, Mark Defford, a former Hilton Head Island General Counsel and candidate for the district in 2020, aircraft mechanic Max Diaz, Ben Frazier, a businessman and perennial candidate, Matt Fulmer, a waiter, Nancy LaCour, a former chief of the U.S. Navy Reserve, Myra Rivera Vasquez, a former second vice chair of the South Carolina Democratic Party. Amongst Libertarian candidates, the presumptive nominee is one Bill Reseed. There's a party called the Alliance primary. The presumptive nominee will be Margo Ellis, a comedian. And the Senate race in Michigan, where the incumbent is Gary Peters, but he is not running for re-election. And amongst Democrats running are Abdul El Said, a former Wayne County Health Director and candidate for governor in 2018, Mallory McMorrow, state senator from the 18th District, and Haley Stevens, U.S. Representative from Michigan's 11th District. And on the Republican side, candidates declared are Mike Rogers, former U.S. Representative from the 8th Congressional District and nominee for Senate in 2024, and Bernadette Smith, a former co-chair of the Michigan Republican Party. And while we're at it, let's bring you some new numbers from the California governor's race. As of April 30th, 2026, from the site 270 to win, we have Steve Hilton at 19.4%, Javier Becerra at 18.2%, and Chad Bianco 13.8%, then Tom Steyer 15.4%. Then we have Katie Porter at approximately 9.6%, Matt Mahan at 5.2%, and then we've got Antonio Villaraigosa at 2.2%, with undecided still at 16%. While another poll conducted April 23rd to the 27th from one Gudluna's strategies showed Javier Becerra 24%, Steve Hilton 23%, Tom Steyer 15%, Chad Bianco 13%, Katie Porter 10%, Matt Mahan 6%, Antonio Villaraigosa 2%, Tony Thurman 1%, other 1%, and undecided at approximately 5%. So we'll get into that more next week, and we'll keep it right here for all elections and elected officials in the city, the state, and the nation. Until next time, everybody, this is your election guru, Mark Braun, saying to you, happy voting and peace.